New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Welcome, dear listeners, to New Dimensions Radio. Today, we're diving into the journey of personal and spiritual exploration with artist Alanis Morissette. Alanis's music resonates profoundly with the depths of human experience. She has won multiple Juno and Grammy Awards, and her music has become a soundtrack for generations. Alanis has been on a journey of inner growth and spiritual inquiry, and continues to share her experiences of the human lifestyle of the path to healing. Indeed, her own podcast has many crossovers with previous New Dimensions guests. Join us as we explore the creative path of healing and service with Alanis Morissette. I'm your host, Travis Glenn. Welcome to New Dimensions. And a warm welcome to you, Alanis.
Oh, thanks, Travis, for having me and for being you.
And for being you. So I thought it would be fun today to flesh everything out, explore together some of the themes that are alive with you and your work in the world through the stepping off point of the lyrics to each of your albums, kind of following a path of succession and your growth and our growth with you. So the first thought I had with that was from Under Rug Swept and the song Utopia. And the invitation or the longing, what I understand, for community, when you say, you know, we would stay and respond and expand and include and allow and forgive.
Yeah, that sounds absolute utopia. You know, like if we were all, if our consciousnesses were all matched, we were different enough and individuated enough, but our consciousness, you know, if it were to be matched enough for all of us to be aware of our interconnectivity. And then it would, you know, my imagination around that utopian vision is that it gets really interesting and really fun. The cross-pollination, the bandying, the thought partnering, you know, what's possible when we lean toward each other and, you know, brainstorm what's possible. So Utopia was written during a time where I was as an empath in the midst of a lifestyle where there's all kinds of behavioral character structures acting out, all of us acting out on each other. And Hollywood can be an interesting unaddressed trauma kind of place. And of course, from that, a lot of beautiful art and a lot of beautiful sort of urgent expression is born.
It's such a fascinating phrase, the urgent expression, right? And so that's required just to be still and allow that to flow through us. And then the pace at which that comes through can feel like an urgency at times.
It does. And a lot of people ask me how long it takes to write a record or a song. And my answer is, it takes me 20 minutes to write it. But in my case, at this point, almost 50 years to live it, you know? So it's a lengthy process, but the capturing of the 3 or 4 minute song for me is actually a pretty exactly urgent one. And it's a trance that I go into. And you know, there's so many beautiful words that could be used, channeling or listening or heeding, whatever the words are. But really, it's me listening, like you just said, getting really still and being available for it.
Absolutely. And I've read somewhere, I think you wrote your first song at age 6, maybe, or something very young. So you seem to have a capacity and an availability very much in your youth. And I'm wondering, just to hold that apart, what your earliest memory then of exploring the big themes of psychology or spirituality, was that also there at age 6? Or when were the bigger questions that may have been precocious occurring to you?
Great question. I remember some of the early readings I read, The Cinderella Complex, when I was 12. So that was one of my first forays into what felt like an organization. You know, what I love about the literature out there, and there's so much research and articles and beautiful books written. It began to organize what felt like the part of my attachment, which was really disorganized, especially relationally. I read Harville Hendrick's Keeping the Love You Find when I was 15. Yes. And I remember thinking, this is beginning to make relationships and the challenges and the beauty and the biochemical responses. It just started to make sense to me in a way that had me want to stay here, because some of the actings out and the traumas that people sort of act out on each other, understandably, it just felt ceaselessly painful to me to not only behold an other, but to certainly behold in my own self, and so much acute sensation in my body that I thought I need to, it was this need for knowledge and understanding so that I could not only transmute my own personal experience, but be able to indicate or clarify for those around me as well. So it became sort of a twofold contribution while I was healing and understanding and clarifying and grieving and all of the beautiful, messy things that we do when we're growing. I also saw that there was a way for me to articulate it that would support those across from me. So that was important. Yes.
What a gift, how those advanced books got to you as a teenager, right? Did you discover them on your own in the library or a bookstore? Yes.
Yeah, I was a bookstore person. I was the kind of person who, if I had a day off, even on tour or traveling, I would just fill my water bottle with tea or whatever it was. And I would just go sit at a bookstore for hours, and that would be my day off. This was before children.
Right.
Now I'm saying, remember books. but yeah, I think just ceaselessly hungry for knowledge, you know, and also just reading from a very discerning place too, you know, just because it was written somewhere and it was someone's passionate opinion didn't make it resonate with me automatically. So I would just read from different sort of perspectives and angles on this whole humanity clarification chase that we're all on.
Well, who was your first experience then outside of a text of like you that you were highlighting and reading? What was the first real conversation you actually had with a person where like, oh, this is going a little bit deeper than what we're doing in entertainment, I suppose?
You mean in terms of psychological and spiritual conversation?
Yeah.
Well, they're all inextricably linked. So any conversation about art is about God to me, because they're synonymous. I remember when I was 10, having connected with a family friend who was in the middle of getting divorced. And I was asking him all these kind of what he considered to be slightly mature relational questions and what the challenges were. And he stopped for a minute and he said, "This is very odd to be having this conversation with a 10-year-old, you realize." And I said, "Yes, sorry. Anyway, so your answer?" So, you know, often just beholding, you know, that 5-wing on the Enneagram.
Yes.
I'm a 4 with a 5-wing. So I love to people watch. And that was actually one of the challenges around fame, was that I was the watcher. I was the beholder and the considerer, you know, and the deep thinker around what I'm beholding and processing. But as a famous person, you become the watchhead.
Okay. Yeah.
So I just had to be careful about creating breaks for myself and whatever that wound up looking like, throwing a wig on at certain times and just watching people in New Orleans at the Mardi Gras or whatever it was. I would find ways to keep beholding, because that's a big piece of my art and my service. Is I consider myself less of an imposer a soapbox imposer. I consider myself more a beholder, and then I see what might be needed here. It could be a glass of water, you know, it could be for me to shut up. It could be for me to smile or offer some sounds of empathy, you know. So 8.1 billion people around the planet. So I think each of us has a unique itch to scratch at any given moment. So for me, the five wing of observing and really taking in what I'm beholding is a big piece of being an artist and being a servant.
It's really great. And I'm going to jump more into our Inya mirror with the 5-4 and the 4-5 we'll together. Yeah. And we're going to keep jumping in, because what you're saying is as servant, I'm wondering also contrasting with the lyrics from Offer, right? Your duty to offer. And so where's the distinction between over-offering and actually being of service?
Great. I mean, if that is a felt sense in the body lock. So the being of service for me, when I'm in stress or not, you know, not quote unquote feeling at my best, although the best is a weird standard to have sometimes, but when I'm not at my best, when I'm in high stress, I default to service. And it's in those moments when I'm a little agitated or not feeling, you know, maybe I'm feeling depressed or I'm feeling terrified. Mm-hmm. I default to two. So I default to overgiving, overfunctioning, you know, and I watch that. I can see it. But this level of self-awareness that's been slowly growing over many decades now has been really valuable for me. It allows me to slow down, to move fast, and really look at where there might be relational challenges. And everything for me comes back to relationality. Not to say that I nail it all the time, trust me. but that's really what it comes down to. And my kids know that. You know, I'll just say, wow, that wasn't relational, or ouch, that sort of creates a chasm in the connection, you know. So those are that's the languaging that I use. Or I'll use the word disconnected, which I know Harville's wife Helen started using a long time ago. And that's really the perfect word. Do I feel connected or do I feel disconnected? And I think of it in a triadic kind of way. Do I feel connected with life, the agape, all?
Yes.
You know, do I feel connected with other, my deeply close friends, my community, my loved ones? Do I feel connected? And then inside, do I feel connected with these parts? Is there a capital S self around to inquire and to see what's really going on in here and what parts in here need to have a voice? So it is triadic. And I can tell, you know, if I'm out of my body and I'm disconnected in here, things are a little wonky. Yeah. So yeah, I keep a loose eye on that.
For our listeners here, I'm wondering if you have a practice or something that you can offer that may say there is a triadic connection that's possible to us. Maybe many of us are just mono-tracking,
triadic,
it's a great concept. It's such a great concept. So how can we start to bring awareness in ourselves if that's something we want to explore for that?
I would say sort of integrating it in a very personal way into your day-to-day life. I know some people who love to meditate. You know, I came home from India, a trip to India, and I was meditating 4 hours a day. And this is when I was living alone for many years and had the bandwidth. Some of us, you know, Peter Levine wrote a really beautiful article about how meditation really can actually trigger a lot of anxiety and have a negative effect. So it's not like there's any one thing that's a panacea or the antidote. You know, it's really a personal thing. And I keep coming back to that. But for me, somatic and spiritual are so linked right now that I find when I'm doing yoga or I'm on my hot mat, which is a ritual I do every night just to kind of get the spine aligned and see where there might be blockages energetically or physically or emotionally, emotions that maybe I've tampered down to contain all day long. And, you know, I just create that freedom to quote unquote move the energy. And what does that look like? It can look different every day. It can look like an ankle. That ankle that just needs to be rotated 150 times while I'm breathing, getting in connection with the breath, and then really just kind of scanning what's up. And there may be 10 parts speaking at once.
I'm speaking with Alanis Morissette. If you want to keep up with what she's doing next, please visit alanis.com, or you can get there through newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You're listening to New Dimensions.
How dare I ignore all now stress?
I'm speaking with artist Alanis Morissette, and we're talking about her journey, both spiritual and psychological, through the course of her musical explorations. And in your song, So-Called Chaos, there's the lyric, "The only way out is through," ultimately. And that sounds pretty intense.
It is. You know, and I've learned the art of titrating and pacing oneself and dipping your toe in and then taking a break. Because I used to be the very, very extreme behaved person where I'd just think, okay, it's you know, it's not 10-minute meditation. It's Vipassana. You know, it's not it's not taking a quick run. It's, you know, two marathons in a row in 2 weeks. Everything was very aggro for a long time. And that's, you know, that overachieving sort of quality is another sort of protracted version of abuse and neglect that a lot of people don't talk about. They talk about the sort of more abject,
interesting,
overt version of neglect and abuse. But any messaging that is being sent to anybody that you can't be who you are, I'm talking about essence. I'm not talking about behaviors that don't create unique and graceful relationality. But yeah, anytime that it's that you're being told, whether it's in academia, a relationship with a narcissist, or anytime you're being told who you are is not okay, that's the only red flag we need.
And so much of that, what you're saying is it's the cultural value of pushing, right? Either pushing
pushing you,
or pushing you away from, like you said, what our essence is or what we are.
Yeah. And often we need to slow down to attune to that. And so there's this, beautiful book called The Hurried Child that I very much resonate with. And it's all about this hurrying and more and go. Mm. And my generation, Gen X, is all about that white knuckle, you know, ignore the body. In fact, just jump out of the body, white knuckle through it. And then, you know, so for me, I created this 5-part sort of steps that have really helped me. The first part is planning. And that could be planning lunch, planning a trip, planning a keynote. Second part is go mode, you know, and third mode is transition. The fourth one is rest and restoration. And the fifth one is reflection and gratitude. So what wound up happening a lot for me is I'd be plan, go, plan, go, plan, go, dead. plan, go, dead. You know, so I've been adding a conscious transition to some degree. You know, and that rest is huge because, you know, I know Arianna Huffington and a lot of us are just going sleep, 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 nap, nap, nap. Easy to say when you're not, you know, a single mother of 4 kids holding down 3 jobs.
Right.
However, any sort of version of rest is powerful. And there's so much biochemical evidence now that there's ways to rejuvenate and restore with conscious awareness of our sleep hygiene, et cetera. But so yeah, and then that reflect time, that's the time where I get to say thank you to everybody, where I get to say, mark and mirror their great value in our community. So when I get to sort of flesh it out and bring the natural human rhythm into the day-to-day, that helps, you know. But that's a unique challenge with a culture that has indoctrinated us into believing productivity before all relationships.
I think that's so important what you're pointing to, just at the microcosm of your organization, that if we're wanting to transform or think about doing something, we need to bring that to our organizations and the way we run that. So you're aware of what you just said, right, with the go, 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 go.
Yes.
But I'm wondering also within your organization, what of these skills have you brought in at a cultural level, at a business level?
I think one of the many ways that this is reflected is in the looking at hierarchical sort of systems. I live for systems understanding. For me, what wound up being thrown out with the bathwater with hierarchy is that there's a delicious system awareness in the hierarchy. The problem comes in when we ascribe value as more or less value, innate value, based on the role in the system, which is ridiculous and the great lie. So for me and my team, no matter who you are or what place you find yourself on the new version of hierarchical sort of, it's a map, really. You know, and I actually use sometimes the military map, you know, and I love the COO, CEO. I came up with chief empathy officer too, which is some kinder version of HR.
CEO, yes.
Chief empathy officer. That'll be my role, by the way. So basically just bringing in anything that's that's appropriate. You know, I still have professional boundaries. I think there is not a lot of talk about the grace and relationality of colleagueship or friendship. So much attention is on flinging, dating, breakups, marriage.
Right.
Is he the right person for you? You know, and as entertaining as that is, and maybe elucidating as that can be, it's a little incomplete. And and there are, you know, within friendships, I mean, these are the people, my dearest friends, I just say, I call them deathbed friends, you know,
okay.
these are the people that I'm going to die with at 132 mm-hmm. or 232. They say in the next 10 years, our longevity awareness and practices will be so expanded that we can be immortal.
Fantastic.
So I'm open to that. But the friendship one is an undersung, not only resource, but you know, the community, all roads lead back to how well cultivated and connected is our community, you know, and this isn't just sort of words now. For me, it went from an interesting topic to touch on to an actual lived experience, which is huge.
It, you know, part of our community and part of what happens when we do get born into specific bodies is we have a song such as In Praise of the Vulnerable Man. Mm. And we also have songs, Sister Blister and Her, right? So there are these different polarities that we get to play with and be no matter what we're born into, but they're also different expressions of how we can participate.
Yes.
And so I'm bringing this up in the context of friendship, right?
Okay.
How this plays out in friendship when you were looking at these. Let's look at Her and Sister Blister. As far as that, if there's a relationship there.
Yeah. So chronologically, Sister Blister came first, and it was a commentary on patriarchy, basically, and how patriarchy specifically affects the female friendships or lack thereof. And it's changing. It's changing so much everywhere I look. There is this real corrective experience for me in healing around women becoming more sisterly. So in the industry that I've been in the 90s, I was very isolated. And at that time, I just felt, you know, women didn't like me as much. I think I was just, I think I triggered a lot of things for people. And that continues to be the case. And for me, the discernment is, are they just triggered because they're projecting onto me all kinds of stuff that they think they aren't? And this actually has nothing to do with me. Or are they triggered because I'm behaving in a way that might need to be looked at, you know? So I spent a lot of time going, is this woman really personally upset with me, or is she just upset about something that has nothing to do with me? So I learned a lot about projection. I learned a lot about being in the public eye and how to survive that. But specifically, Sister Blister was a commentary on the male gaze, the male lens. So I see a lot of women bodies becoming hyper-masculinized in order to quote unquote function in a patriarchal context. And that makes perfect sense to me that we would do that. However, it's not shifting the perspective or bringing in a female gaze or a feminine gaze, as I like to call it. I don't call it the feminist movement. I call it the feminine movement, because the feminine movement is burgeoning in male and female and non-gender identifying bodies all over the place. So this isn't just a woman thing, although we are the most directly affected. And we don't even know it sometimes. We're so indoctrinated into the male gaze that we just think we're cooking along. Without sometimes considering the fact that this is a very patriarchal perspective that I've taken into the marrow of my bones. And so just to become awakened around that, seeing where I skew toward, and some of the white knuckling we just talked about is patriarchy also, right? It's industry or bust, money above humans.
Exactly that. And I really, again, that The lyrics inspired me and spoke to me specifically, because I was like, here's a voice in the celebrity, in the white knuckling, in the making of business, and bringing this to a large audience, bringing these questions, bringing this consideration of what's happening with that. And then maybe, I don't know if you would put it in these words, but a counterbalance with In Praise of the Vulnerable Man is really asking for that quality to be everywhere and with anyone.
Yes.
And to lead your cavalry home.
The funny thing about that song is I wrote it about somebody and I played it for them, and they said their first response was, who's this about?
Oh, really?
And that's just the part of me that can fantasize. I'm such a potential seer. I'm just, this is what's possible. You know, I'm a possibility.
You are the greatest man I've ever met. and you didn't know it.
Yes. He's like, so who's this about? I'm like, good question. Anyway, it's about who I wanted you to be.
Absolutely.
Anyway. Yeah, there is a sweet brotherhood that I have, and it winds up being such that the men that I resonate with most in terms of friendship, they have a really cultivated or just natural feminine awareness, you know? So on the continuum of how much femininity and masculinity is playing out in our bodies and our lifestyles and our choices, you know, I swim somewhere around the middle. I consider myself to be pretty androgynous, but to bring awareness of when I'm leaning on that hyper masculinity and not overdo it, you know, because as women, our testosterone and all our hormones are just completely different. It comes from our adrenals in women bodies, and from men, it comes from their testes. So a man and a woman body can do the same amount on any given day. But then at the end of the day, the woman is a lot more depleted. Not that she'll show it, but there's an actual, a higher level of depletion just based on how our bodies are built differently. So not only for the psychological well-being of the feminine movement, but also for the physical longevity well-being too. It's important to understand these only because it brings more of a vitality to our lives.
And now as a mother and raising children in partnership, how do you negotiate this movement? Is it set in stone? Is it day to day? What's going on now?
Yeah, it's a day to day. You mean in terms of the interplay of masculine feminine and how that shows up in parenthood?
Yeah. For you specifically.
Yeah, for me specifically, it's around attuning to the moment. It's just seeing, you know, right now empathy and silence is clutch. The other time it might be, you know, even with my puppies, there are times softness isn't working and I have to get a little alpha, you know, and then they're like, okay, mom, I remember now. So even with my kids, you know, just sort of evidencing this kind of certainty, and masculine gorgeousness, the divine masculine, you know. And I spent a few days a couple of weeks ago just really doing these practices with two men whom I'd been working with, just saying, you know, can I bask in receiving? This was an experiment. Okay. Can I bask in the receiving of the divine masculine offering love to me that is not transactional, that is just beholding me and loving me, as opposed to, I want something from you. I want sex. I want your thoughts. I want your help. I want your mommying, or whatever it is, you know, to just have a moment where I could bask in that. And that was a game changer for me, because, you know, I almost sort of forcefully created a practice where I had to force myself to receive and bask in this divine masculine love. So I have a lot of brothers who do it, and I support them in doing it wholeheartedly.
I'm speaking with Alanis Morissette. If you want to keep up with what she's doing these days, please visit alanis.com. Or you can get there through newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Thank you, frailty. Thank you, consequence. Thank you, silence. The moment I let go, was the moment I got more than I could handle. The moment I jumped off of it was the moment I touched down.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast